Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Deborah Bogan. Deborah Bogan's full-length collection, Landscape with Silos, was a 2004 National Poetry Series finalist and won the 2005 X.J. Kennedy Poetry Prize. Her poetry has appeared in Shenandoah, the Gettysburg Review, Field, Margie, and Poetry International. Her chapbook, Living by the Children's Cemetery, was selected by Edward Hirsch as winner of the 2002 Byline Press chapbook competition. She is a native of North Dakota. For the past 7 years, she has run a free writing workshop in her Pittsburgh living room every Monday night. Hi, Deborah. How are you doing?
Hi. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. And especially because last time you didn't have your book, but now you have this Landscape with Silos book. And congratulations on winning the X.J. Kennedy Prize.
Thanks. It's a nice thing to have happen for anyone.
That's right, isn't it? Okay. So you're reading some poems from that book.
I am going to read from the book.
Okay.
The barn holds the sky up. Most nights, we can't sleep. We sit out till the moon shows. If it's late, if I know the kids won't wake, I strip and lay full out on the grass. Orion's up there, a big professor in his lecture hall. Tonight, he says, I have a great deal of material to cover. And the Bible says a good man loves the light. Only the wicked love what's hidden. But I think that's just talk. Just talk, I think. And when the grass is wet like this and cool, I feel empty, free almost. Some say the moon makes things look strange. I think it lets us see how strange things are. Scarecrows in their wedding clothes. The way light snows on trees. The Bible says the sun's got one kind of glory, the moon another. I see best in moonlit glory. Well, as you mentioned, I spent a lot of time growing up in North Dakota. My grandparents and aunts and uncles and all kinds of folks lived there. And one of the things I came to know as an adult was that the farmland and farm community that I adored as very rural was actually sitting on top of more nuclear warheads that were gathered than any other place on the planet at that time. So this poem is called Landscape with Silos. One nail sticking up in a pile of boards. Air bladders from fish brought home for supper. Sugar in green glass bowls, glittering rattlesnakes. The palsied ghosts of cloud-stained women, shadows of railroad men far from their homes, a deep freeze filled with molasses cookies, broken concrete, lilacs, thunder. We drank water from old pipes, picnicked under windbreaks, peach pits and eggshells, and in the glove box, roadmaps to the river, to the reservation, to Fargo and Minot, but no maps to the silos where men tended missiles so big we didn't even dream about them. They didn't scare us, those missiles. Not the men, either, who rose like bankers, sat calmly at the counter, starched and pressed. Keys jingled on their belts. They ordered root beer and black bottom pie. Bedtime story. The apple, the lips, the drop of blood, the thorn, the bloom in the young girl's cheeks. A rosy warmth. You feel the heat, the rocking motion, blanket's weight. This is the start of a small dream, Lazy Campfire, Gypsy Song. This is the song of the peddler's wagon, Peak of Stocking, Lusty Daughter. This is desire lapping the edge, dark red flowers, smell of smoke. These are the songs of the drunken men eating sausages made from blood. This is you in your father's arms. Are you dreaming now? Are you dreaming yet? There's darkness ahead. Shadowy wolves, their jaundiced eyes, their long slick tongues. Can you hear the bells? Do you feel the pull? The night air chills. You reach for fire. You see the daughter sent to the stream, buckets swinging back and forth. This is a dream, the start of a dream. Who is the girl? The wolves advance. I'm going to read the title poem from my first chapbook, Living by the Children's Cemetery. One. For weeks, I've ignored a presence, stillness, and faceless blue breath on the cellar windows. But tonight, beyond the yard, moon-stained crosses quiver like delicate antennae. Before I climb into bed, I press a hand to the window and feel the cold. Two. The moon's stuck in a milk bottle. An ancient horse tack hangs on the porch where my grandfather drank, while upstairs Edith screamed my mother into this world. Textbooks say I was there too, an incipient presence, and I want to name that, what that was. I want to name it like the stones in the cemetery want to name something. Where did we learn to surrender our children to priests who bless them, who lift them high amid incense and smoke, and take them to meet the Holy of Holies? Three. Ants come out of the earth, long coated helixes that carry away what's been lost in the dark. They try to help me understand the cemetery's work, how we must give up what we cannot mend or keep. Still, it hurts, like a fist clenched too long. We must learn to lie flat, to enter their darkness with our hearts and our useless wings open. Four. Standing by these small graves in Garrison, North Dakota, I want some kind of consolation. I want wisdom. And you do too. You there, at the kitchen sink in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, in Billings, Montana, and Casper, Wyoming, and you up late in Vermont, and you in the Black Hills of Tennessee. How do we accept the soil that fills their mouths? How do we ever go inside again?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Deborah Bogan, reading from her latest book, Landscape with Silos. I want to ask you about growing up in North Dakota and this, what must have been very strange experience of having this farmland and these missiles coming up out of the farmland. I mean, maybe not for a child. Maybe it was a magical, strange event. I don't know. What was that like?
The time I spent in North Dakota, my parents had actually moved to Montana and I lived there, but I was back in North Dakota all the time to stay with relatives. It was very common. And it was very fairy tale like for a kid. I was on my uncle's farm. I was in a small town full of everyone I was related to. You ran free. Nobody had to know where you were. Your grandmother made cookies every day. It was that kind of fun thing. What I didn't know was that the economy, to the extent that there is an economy in North Dakota, was entirely based on the military. So I knew there were bases. And, of course, you saw fellows in uniform all the time. It just was an accepted normal thing. And it was very strange later to understand what that had actually been.
Do you think that had anything to do with your becoming a poet? Or do you think that is just something that came up for you as a writer at a later time?
Well, let's see. I think one thing that I think moved me to be a poet was around my brain, and I'm sure this is common among many, maybe many kinds of people, but certainly poets, many different things will be floating at the same time. Very personal things, global disaster things, funny things, odd things, you know, sarcastic, snide things. And part of me wants to, at some moment, be able to put those in a relationship, some constellation that's in one place. Why am I thinking of those at the same time? So I think in some ways we are shaped by those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you have the global disaster next to the funny thing and you put words to that, people can try to lock you up.
That's but, right. Or you can say dark humor, dark, yeah, dark humor.
Very dark. But, people in responding to your work, everyone is talking about the intelligence of Deborah Bogan, the intelligent poems, and you know, Carol Frost, brimming with intelligence, Betty Adcock, the series judge who chose your book, A Lively Intelligence. And what I'm seeing in your work when I'm reading it, I feel this, what I'm seeing is this ravenous curiosity that is really interesting, and this sense of if this, then this, or why this, what about this? And one thing I really like is that the seams of this thinking are not hidden, but sort of foregrounded as subject. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that as aesthetic choice in your work.
I hope that I'm actually exercising aesthetic choice in my work. I intend to. But I think, and this again, probably, you know, we're much more common than we think, is that the poem ends up having its way with me. So I'm always trying to, I would say that I begin to write constantly trying to interrogate the poem. Why are you bothering me? Why am I writing this? How is this going to turn into something that might be interesting in some way? And all you have to do, I mean, the only way you can really do that is to think hard about what you see on the page in front of you.
Okay. I like that because that's what I'm always telling my students. Yeah, let the poem tell you what it needs. And
it's not easy. I mean, you can think, well, then you're passive if you're going to let the poem tell you, but it's the exact opposite of that. You have to be quite active, but you listen to the poem all the time. And you have to trust that there's some reason this is coming to you.
Yeah, knocking at your door.
You know.
Okay, how about more poems?
Okay, and in fact, that leads into what I wanted to read next. I should just confess right off that I watch TV. And one of the things I like to do is watch the History Channel and stuff that's just weird. And it turned out that at the beginning, just before this current war was beginning, I happened to be watching this television history show about Alexander and about how Aristotle had been Alexander's teacher, which is just fascinating to me right off when you consider Alexander's reputation and Aristotle's. And so this is the poem that sort of came out of the television episode at the beginning of the war. It's called The Poem Listens to Its President on TV. Oh, it wants to be beautiful, to be naked and necessary. It gestures towards sparrows, hums under its breath. But the poem's picking up brutish habits, bared teeth in the bathroom mirror, a vaguely collisionous grin. The poem shuts its eyes, thinks, Hannibal was a boy mad for power who loved elephants and feared slave girls. A boy who licked the tips of his arrows before he put them to flight. So the poem presses the mute, but it can still see the face. It thinks of Alexander's famous dream, his mother's head on another man's pike. And Aristotle was Alexander's teacher, it thinks. That's the kind of thing that makes the poem uneasy. The way Alexander brought a love of learning to the world with his bloody sword, whacking at people, bashing them, their soft bits of flesh exposed to the air, crusting, turning black. He saved those people from their chieftains and their ignorance, tore sons from their mothers, and laid harsh leather harnesses on their bloodied shoulders so they could pull his carts. So it turned out that about the time that I was writing a series of poems in which the poem got to do a lot of the acting, I was in San Francisco and there was a State of the Union address. And after the State of the Union address, I went to the Cafe Trieste, which is a marvelous cafe in San Francisco. And it was one of those experiences other writers have had where you can basically sit down and take dictation from the people at the tables and you get this poem. After the State of the Union, the poem goes out for coffee. At the Rebel Cafe, the inmates materialized. Everyone said the president looked medicated, and of themselves, I'm a little off today. I'm a little off. Sam's run into some luck, an inheritance, 20 or 30,000. I'm starting a small press, he says. All I have to do is keep my head together. Jeffrey's gotten a tip, a good tip. He just needs his medical papers. In the back booth, the bald guy asks, "Do you speak Mandarin or mandolin?" This is a question that also concerns the poem. Across the street, the stained glass windows continue their slow melt. And of course, once you let the poem out of the bag, it wants to do all kinds of things. So there's a series in the book where the poem gets to do that. And this is called The Poem Enters the Talent Show. At this time, I always have to say, especially to a younger audience, there's a reference in here to vinyl records, round records that you play with diamond-tipped needles. So I'm sure everyone sort of knows what that is as a retro item now. But in my growing up, it wasn't a retro item. The Poem Enters the Talent Show. Your baton is thin and shiny. There's a circle on the stage. You must stay inside this circle until your routine is finished. You step into the circle willingly as they put your music on the machine. The music's round. It's a circle. The needle's a diamond extracting the music. Most diamonds come from Africa. Some have been deep inside the rectums of the diggers. He was found out, the one who cut this diamond from rock. But diamond-tipped needles, free music from vinyl, and Ella Fitzgerald is some of the music they free. You get tired. When you get to the end, you think there will be an answer to all your questions. But there's just the circle. And what's outside the circle? You hurl your baton high, hoping you can catch it. And then just one more poem where the poem acts. This is called, and this is how writing goes. I'm not the only one that has this experience. You get up from your machine to go do a chore. The poem goes to the kitchen to empty the dishwasher, but ends up praying. Grace must be like this sun streak on the linoleum. This unexpected elegance, a rope of gold up which we pull ourselves amazed, having thought it gone, this thing which penetrates, which chooses us, which illumines one moment so that the book of hours opens to a single letter, loved and labored over, lavished and extravagantly gilded. Say, a mystic vowel embellished in blue, a hint of scarlet, and in the center nothing, the white suddenly framed as a field of Queen Anne's lace, or the snow-draped steps, door to another geography. Let me move through it, this door. Let me see the monk bent over the table, his brushes of camel's hair and mink, his window stabbed by sun, a lance that leaves a wound of gold. Transfiguration. Marked change. A sudden emanation. On a page. On linoleum. Amen.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Deborah Bogan, reading from her new book, Landscape with Silos. I know that it was a long road to your first book, and that's a pretty common experience. But I also know that there are a lot of writers out there who have not gotten that book yet. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that experience of sending your work out, and if you considered quitting or...
Yes. That was a quick answer. About that. Yes, I did. I mean, on and off, I think most people do. It did take me a long time to get my book published. And, you know, I'm still sending out poems and getting rejections and getting acceptances right now. And it took me a while to disassociate myself from that process and have a part of me that's simply my own secretary who goes ahead and does the work. You're going to have to do it. If you want it, you're going to have to do it. And you're going to have to face the fact that in the case of getting a book, if you're not incredibly brilliant, must happen for some people much more easily, you're even in a sense getting in line. You know, that there are people who would love to publish your work, but they can't yet. And the good news is there's a lot of people writing really well. And the bad news is the competition is stiff. So you just have to have the days, you know, when the day comes when you decide maybe you're no good or you shouldn't be doing this or why are you wasting time, or if you are foolish enough to add up the expenses.
Yeah, don't do that. Add it,
you know,
up. That's
just
what I said.
Trying to write those little checks and do what you need to do.
Yeah.
Then you can make it happen. Can I give a plug to a book about writing? And it's not
sure.
Yeah, Carolyn C. S-E-E has a book called Making the Literary Life, and that was an actual help to me because she made it sort of a fun kind of thing where you just didn't take it all so seriously. Now I tell people that I work with—I don't know if I should call them students, but people I help get started—the first time they send their work to a good journal, they should consider that they're introducing themselves to the editors. And that's what they're doing. And if they keep sending those editors good work, eventually it's possible they'll establish a relationship that'll be really useful for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it is fun. I mean, you do want the work out there. You want to be part of that conversation. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot you can do along the way that makes the process easier to bear. One is to review books and read a lot of books. You know, get involved in that discussion. Talk about other writers' work. Get to know them. That makes it a lot more fun.
And you did that. You wrote reviews.
Yeah, I started doing reviews pretty early on just because I thought that it was important for poets to be looking at other poets' work, that the review should be by poets.
Mm-hmm.
And also I need it as an educational tool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically it helps me to really pay attention. It's hard to really pay attention to so many good books. But if you have to write a review of someone's work, you will spend time and get to know it.
Right. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. I know that you have some new poems that you're working on. Is there a direction or something different that's happening with your work now?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, there is. And I have a lot of new work coming out, so that'll be fun and some of that. And that's encouraging because then you get the feeling that maybe this new direction you're taking isn't hopeless if people are willing to publish the work. But I came from a religious background, a very strict religious background, and that didn't work for me. And I'm a person who tried to make it work really hard. I gave it my all, I think. And we always laugh, you know, the sort of the sensible thing you'd say is if you decided that was not the right thing you could do or live by and so forth, you just drop it and move on. It doesn't work that way. The moving on part's a little weird, and it keeps coming back in different ways. So the second book basically sort of takes on a lot of the things that maybe I didn't take on as a kid and a teenager and a young adult and tries to explore them in a different way.
Do you have a new poem that you could read? Or
I actually don't have a poem here from that book, so
okay.
Bad me.
Well, how about more poems then?
Okay. But they'll be out in journals. Let's see. Everyone I know is either personally dealing with or has friends that they're dealing with who have various sorts of mental troubles, me on a certain day. You know, this is a crazy world. If you're not a little neurotic, you should wonder about yourself. And it's hard to sort out how to deal with that. So this was a poem about what you sort of do as people are trying to get medical help and sort of live in the world. It's called It's About Heaven. It's about heaven. These are the words she said. And this is what I know about the shape of words. If you drop the lower jaw, a soft sound comes out. But we have been all day at the specialist, and this is what he knows and how he looks and what he cares about. A, studies have been done. B, he wears a bow tie with a sense of purpose. C, he tells her there's a way to handle the depression. Then he conducts the interview. She says, I have been leavened all my life. He hears, I've been 11 all my life. She says, the angels flew, clouds purpled and darkened. He hears, the angle skewed, I was disheartened. I know the pain she carries is in a little bucket, like a bucket of pennies. She can't buy much with it, but she can't put it down. Still, the specialist is happy. He says the new medication has a 50% chance of working, that we are halfway to heaven again. So we ride home on the bus. I relax my jaw, say halo and sparrow. Outside, God has placed strategic clouds. Her neck aches from looking up. I have a lot of political poems. I didn't know that for a long time. People started calling me a political poet. Okay, this is a poem that I wrote. As this war was beginning, my daughter was pregnant with my now 4-year-old grandchild. And I was thinking of all the young women in Iraq who were expecting to give birth soon. On the birth of your daughter. May she live in an unknown place, far from wealth or oil or magnitude, beyond the reach of power or kings. May she sleep in a cradle of wood. May the water there flow like water. May the sky maintain its shy demeanor. May what falls wet your earth. Let that rumble be thunder.
The poetry of Deborah Bogan, reading from her book, Landscape with Silos. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have the work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Waity. Tonight's sound engineer is Amy Sutton. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.